Hi, I'm Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment. This is Episode 87, continuing our coverage of Lightbringer, the sixth installment in Pierce Brown's Red Rising saga.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Nick. This episode is titled The Daughters, and we'll be discussing Lyria and Darrow's POVs from Chapter 57 through Chapter 63 in Tempest, Part 3 of Lightbringer.
And I'm regular guest host Seth, here to remind you that our Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free outside of the chapters we cover in each episode.
That said, don't forget that the opinions of those of us as individuals don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole. Though, let's be real, usually we're all on the same page, or at least very close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon. With 10 tiers ranging from $1 a month to $40 a month, it offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment. Okay, so we've already had a brief intro to the Daughters of Ares, not Athena, as we said several times in our last episode, which is totally on me, but also shouldn't they be the Daughters of Athena?
They should. They really should.
Now, though, it's time to really dig into what all is going on there.
As the Archie makes its way down to Europa, Lyria has apparently decided to sneak around and confront Sigurd with questions about Volga. But he is too low on the totem pole to know much other than that she's Fa's granddaughter, though he calls her daughter, and is his constant shadow, having even been given a command for the attack on Callisto. Of course, Lyria doesn't want to believe any of this, but she also doesn't outright call Sigurd a liar, eventually leaving him to wander the ship, finding Aure telling stories to the children they saved about how they will be safe in the deep, and turning away from that conversation only to run into Sevro. But hey, shocker! This time, Sevro is actually kind of friendly with her. I mean, sure, when she admits she'd want a Pegasus, he basically tells her they're awful, but he also offers her sun butter, and they actually have a real conversation, complete with Sevro actually admitting that he doesn't want to don the Ares helmet because it was his father's prison, and Lyria hinting that maybe, just maybe, Sevro isn't quite right about that. Soon enough, they've landed on Europa, and it's time for apparently everyone but Cassius to head down to Helison, Athena's secret stronghold. There's no way to get the Archie down there, and he refuses to leave his home unattended. After explaining as much to Lyria, he also insists that she seek him out before making any rash decisions about chasing after Volga. And listen, we hate that these two besties are having to say goodbye, but also when it comes to how adorbs their conversation is, we love to see it. Now, Lyria might have been excited to meet Keon face-to-face at first, but the more she sees of the other Red, the more she dislikes her, and once they're all on the submarine, the closer they get to their destination, the more noticeable it is that something's not right with Darrow, Sevro, and Diomedes. Lyria sees people approaching the sub and realizes they have manacles in their hands, but when she tries to warn Darrow, he just seems to give in, even telling Sevro not to fight them. While Lyria is able to get a hold of a pistol, someone knocks her on the head, and though she notes that Aure is angry, crying and exclaiming that this is not who we are, when Athena strides onto the sub, the pink falls to her knees, only to be praised for bringing Athena all she asked for and more, and when Lyria tries to ask Aure what this is, Athena answers for her, justice at last. Apparently, despite Lyria's attempt at protecting Darrow, she is allowed to stay with Aure and won't be harmed, which Darrow learns when he wakes, chained to the floor of a cold room with Athena sitting nearby. She promises that Sevro is safe as well, but the fact that she holds the path to the veil, which Darrow did not bring with him, means she has the Archimedes. So things likely don't bode well for Cassius any more than they do for Diomedes or Darrow himself.
Sure enough, Darrow isn't exactly well-versed in how to talk to Athena, who, while insisting it's not when, but if he's found guilty, also shows off the weapon, a hosta named Pyrphoros that will be used to execute him. And sure, she lets Darrow have Pax's grav bite key back, but she also leaves him with a holo cube that plays the recordings of interrogations and executions of the sons he betrayed in the Rim, who did not shout Ares or Io's names before they died, but rather Darrow's. Soon the Daughters of Ares assemble for Darrow's trial, and when he faces them, he attempts to look as humble as possible, which isn't easy considering he's feet taller than most of them, and to top it all off, they dressed him in a gold cape. Aure attempts to advise him, but despite the testimonies of her, Sevro, and Lyria, Athena is putting Darrow's life in the hands of all the daughters, and that's that. So what does Darrow do? Why, give a really, really big Darrow speech, of course. Granted, it mostly consists of him admitting he's guilty of all the things they're accusing him of, telling them they should spare Diomedes in the names of change, progress, and unity, and concluding with the fact that he's not going to ask them for forgiveness, only that they succeed where he failed and not surrender their dream, the dream of liberty for all of the colors, to fear. Diomedes is up next and has even less of an argument for them, simply telling them Golds broke their contract with the low colors and they should take their due. He and Darrow are then led away to await the verdict, and who is waiting in the cell for them but Cassius, because of course he tried to rescue them and obviously that failed miserably. They can hear the daughters cheering, so yeah, it really doesn't sound like things are looking good for any of them. And maybe it's this that leads to Diomedes finally speaking up about Kalike, and that while he has no outright evidence, he believes it's all Atlas. And Darrow is quick to agree, though he doesn't think it's just about punishing the Ra's, but rather reminding the Rim as a whole what fear is, and ushering none other than Lysander into power. Cassius refuses to believe this, but in the end, Lysander was on the dustmaker at Kalike, so it's hard to believe he's alive anyway. And though Cassius is even more upset by this, Darrow can't help but hope it's true.
And hey, turns out he might get a chance to find out, because when some daughters drag Darrow, Cassius, and Diomedes in front of Athena again, it's not back to the dais, but to a war room. Not only did Athena have people listening to their conversation, but Ares himself told her that Darrow can shatter Atlas's illusion. Wait a second! Whoops did what? Just then, all light and sound are sucked out of the room, and someone gives an old speech of Ares. And when the twilight helm is turned off, it's Sevro, of course! And all that cheering they heard from their cell was actually because Sevro, kinda with Athena's help, in fact, was telling the daughters that Ares fucked up too. Oh, and by the way, Ares tried to show that they needed all types, builders, shields, Freys, whoops, wrong series, I meant allies who show up late, and of course, the Reaper, who totally has a plan, right? Right? Well, Darrow would prefer that plan to involve Athena's ships, but they're too far away. So it's got to be Ashfar or bust. Unfortunately, once Fa is dead, Darrow will have to return to face his sentence. But for now, he's safe, as is Cassius, who's to be Sevro's charge. As for Diomedes, he'll be allowed to live too, if he signs off on abolishing the hierarchy, allowing everyone to choose their own vocations, and apparently some other things as well. Which Diomedes, of course, balks at, but Ori insists that they want him to be their Virginia Augustus, and once he gives his oath, he'll be free to fight alongside Darrow. It takes Lyria infiltrating a war room under the guise of being Darrow's niece Rona for us to learn that Diomedes must have given that oath because he's there with Darrow, Cassius, Sevro, and the daughters, planning, well, whatever it is they're planning, of which Lyria sees very little before Sevro grabs her by the ear and drags her out. Besides, she only snuck in because she insists on talking to Darrow about the whole Volga deal, because she wants to help, and after the speech he gave about how this is everyone's fight, she's not about to just let him go and tell her no. Everyone might think Volga's completely gone over to Fa, but Lyria refuses to believe she's a lost cause, and means to use whatever standing she has with her friend to bring Volga back around to the Republic. Even though Darrow reminds Lyria they can't protect her, Sevro actually says the truffle pig should get her shot. She's earned it, after all. Setting aside whatever thing the boys are going to do, it sounds like Lyria's off to see her Volga, most important daughter to Fa.
All right, seriously, though, do we ever need Freys? I don't think we need Freys, like, ever, in any series.
No, it was just, I was writing the summary, yeah. And I was like, this is very familiar sounding. Freys. We'll get into who it actually was about in a bit, but... Oh, yeah. When Lyria goes to talk to Sigurd, he might not know much about Volga, but he certainly has good insights into obsidians and even society, really, as a whole.
Because when Lyria asks if he knows Volga, he says he knows the name and that there are not many women obsidian among us. Part of the stupidity that brought us out here was blaming them for our years of slavery. They sold us, their boys, it is true, but it was an impossible choice. Sell us or all their children die, boys and girls. Gold is good at shifting blame. He does slip up by calling Volga a freak born from a grimace tube, but when Lyria snaps at him that she's not a freak, Sigurd simply shows his sigils and says, "We are all freaks. They made us so."
That's actually really insightful.
Yeah. And he's not just talking about obsidians.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, it's like it's.
It's all sigils. They've created us, essentially. At this point, yes, there's actual breeding and stuff involved, but how do we think they got created in the first place, y'all?
Yeah.
Like, you'd be calling Volga a freak, but yeah. How do you all think you exist? How do you think the colors exist? Carving and test tubes, probably.
Absolutely. You know, I would have loved to have been there for the meeting, whichever meeting this got decided in. I would love to have been there for that. Pierce, write us a short story. Anyway.
Let's make it all better.
Well, all and we're going to do is divide society into castes based on skin color. Nothing can go wrong.
And it's like the narrator from Arrested Development. And yet.
Yeah.
Thankfully, Lyria's conversation with Severo, surprisingly, goes much better than the one with Sigurd did.
Listen, they actually open up to each other, though Severo tries to insist it's because he doesn't talk to Deadweight, and apparently, at the moment, Lyria isn't useless.
However, she insists with Severo, just as she did with Sigurd, that Bolga can't be truly marching with Fa.
But Severo reminds her she didn't call Sigurd a liar, continuing, you know why? Because you know that people can and will disappoint you. Even this friend of yours is going to let you down.
Weirdly enough, even though Lyria tries to turn this around on him by bringing up why he won't wear his father's helmet, once Severo actually admits that he doesn't want to wear it because it was something like a prison for Fichtner, Lyria actually tries to give him advice, make him feel better.
He might walk away, but it doesn't seem to be the bad kind of walking away. So there's that.
Yeah, and he'll keep talking to her as long as she doesn't turn useless again. So,
I think with him, and I could be giving him too much credit, that it might be like an on-off switch. Like once you're in the useful category, you're in the useful category.
But I mostly think he's just teasing her, honestly.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. Teasing with Severo could take several forms, up to and including weapons.
Anyway.
Anyway, indeed. We always joke about how good Lysander is at describing and giving insight on people because of the stupid Kwisatz Haderach thing. Anyway, but perhaps these chapters are proof that Lyria is, in fact, really good at having awesome conversations with people. Maybe it sounds silly, but it doesn't, especially when soon after the aforementioned interaction with Severo, she has what amounts to a really sweet talk with Cassius.
First, him teasing her about not cleaning up the latrines and then basically referring to her as one of his favorites and winking at her. It was like, so cute. It's so cute.
Followed by his concern over her possibly going after Volga. Shoot, even him calling her foul ragamuffin is sweet, damn it.
Plus, he gives her a flask to take with her. And then before she leaves him, she compliments him on what he did on Io. And even as she thinks he doesn't need compliments from her, she tells him, I just think you're a good man and you have a huge heart. And I don't think people say that enough. Just wanted you to know I see it, Bellona. And for once, Cassius doesn't have an ironic response. And Lyria goes on to describe his eyes glitter. And he bends, looks into my eyes, and kisses me on the cheek. I'm filled with an urge to protect him and his too fragile heart.
And then Cassius tells her, go on now, before I try to keep you.
Sorry, not sorry. Be still my heart. Also, did anyone else catch feelings remembering the 1996 Casper movie? When Devon Sawa is dancing with Christina Ricci, and he's like, can I keep you?
Oh.
And I don't mean that Cassius and Lyria this is a romantic thing between them at right. all, okay? No. I don't. But when he said that line, that's all I could think of was that scene.
That's real sweet.
I never saw that movie.
Oh, that's depressing. It's October. Watch Casper, damn it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe. Look, I got a lot of books to read.
It's like an hour and a half long. It's got a really great cast, though. You should definitely watch it, especially as it's October. It's Halloween month.
Yeah, all right. We'll see. No promises.
Yeah.
Promises.
Lyria might end up pretty darn angry with Aure, but before, you know, all of that, she has a moment with the pink, too.
Sure, when Lyria asks Aure about Kian, you don't like her, do you? Aure simply replies, I didn't say that.
So Lyria admits she doesn't like the other red, and Aure says, it takes all kinds to wage a war. Could you imagine her entertaining guests in the Raw Court?
Lyra tells her, I can't imagine you there either. And Aure is struck by this and thanks her. And it's a really short, simple conversation, but I think it says so much about both of them. Lyria sees Aure as so much more than just a pink who would have been in that court. She literally can't even picture Aure there. And Aure is just so struck by the fact that Lyria sees that too, because she surely never felt at home there either. I don't know. I really like it. Like I said, Lyria is really great at having conversations with people.
I will say that Takes All Kinds reminds me of old Lighthouse Jeffers, a sketch from The State, where the joke is basically he's into S&M. That's the joke. But these three guys from New York have a flat tire, and he's like, you ever go into them sadomasochism bars? They're like, no, we like sports bars. Oh, sports bars, eh? Well, takes all kinds.
All that said, as much as Lyria seems to be doing a great job of understanding others and how to talk to them, Darrow does not, at least not these reds from the rim.
Seriously, within minutes of waking up in Athena's presence, he tries to pull the we're both reds card, and she straight up retorts, red, me? I suppose I came from a mine, like you. Ours floated over Jupiter. I was sorted as a girl. Since I was not chosen to be a breeder, my breasts were cauterized shortly after puberty. I was selected to be a gas fly to gather helium from Jupiter on Erlon wings. Red. I have never been red, nor gray, nor gold. I am a human being. You may look at me with the eyes of the masters, but you will not sort me according to their inhuman labels.
Those last couple sentences are really great. I am a human being, especially. But also, wow. So I guess on Mars, all the red women are supposed to be breeders and don't get their breasts cauterized. We've never heard this before.
No, I just also want to point out that the rim is supposed to be the better of the two places to live. If you're not a gold, to go on with the gross idea that you posited, Tara, I think perhaps, because as I recall, when they're like, too many reds have died, we're running out of reds. They're like, hey, fill them tunnels with that aphrodisiac gas. Just pump it in there.
Mm-hmm.
Just get it on in. So,
but also, like, why the breasts? I guess because they'd be in the way of the suits that they're wearing in space. That's the only thing I can think of, because while breasts are absolutely a great thing when you are a femme person having sex and have those nerve endings and stuff, I will say this, they are a great thing for that. You were chosen to be a breeder, so that's what they got rid of?
I don't know. I mean, at least they didn't do a clitorectomy, I guess.
Yeah, that thought crossed my mind too, and I was like, this is awful.
Can we also just acknowledge how fucked up it is that I'm like, well, at least they didn't cut that off? I mean, God, why? I don't know. It just seems like, well, we need to be able to tell one from the other quickly. So, I don't know. Burn off her boobs.
I have to imagine it has something to do with them fitting into the suits. That's the only thing that makes sense here. It's disgusting no matter what, don't get me wrong. But that's the only thing that makes sense here. But it is fucked up that it's like, well, at least they didn't.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Anyway. Darrow's all, when I'm found guilty, and Athena's all, if you're found guilty, but then as mentioned, goes on to immediately show off the weapon of execution, which...
It's a Hasta, the rim style of razor, seemingly made of black spar onyxinium, with the forbidden song etched into the side of the blade, and they've named it Pyrphoros, or Firebearer.
Let's take a beat for History Lessons with Tara. This reference to Pyrphoros is almost certainly in regard to Prometheus Pyrphoros, which was likely the final play in the Promethea trilogy. It was believed to be written by Aeschylus. However, only a single line of this purported third play has survived the test of time. And it's a bit of dialogue that states quiet where need is and talking to the point.
That's a little on point, if you ask me.
It really is.
I mean, maybe if you knew that piece of trivia and could make it make sense, why not?
I feel like I'm super late to the game with these history lessons of Tara, but I've got one for our next episode too that I'm kind of excited about, and I feel like I've been just totally missing out on all the random things that I learned by studying Latin and Greek history.
I'm very excited to learn more history.
Yes, the history and mythic underpinnings of this terrible, terrible society. it's reminding me, because you're talking about Greek plays, I still remember a bit from undergrad about Greek plays, because when we were studying for this, a friend of mine made it into a very short song, and that's still in my head 25 years later, just kicking around in there. Fun times.
I get that Ori didn't mean for all of this to happen, by the way, but it's still frustrating that she, of all people, didn't slash couldn't see through her maybe hero worship of Athena to realize that her leader did what, a 180, going from preaching forgiveness to literally carrying a gun.
Yeah, she spoke up for Darrow and presumably Diomedes as well, along with Severo and Lyria, but there's nothing else she could do other than look at Darrow with eyes filled with acceptance and fierce love and tell him, "I expected you to be an arrogant tyrant. That is what they see. Show them what you showed me. Show them who you are. A traveler on a path."
Which maybe he kind of does, because, and now, for the first time in a long time, it's Big Darrow speech time. It's been a while since we got one of these at all, let alone a really big one.
Though, let's be real, this one is not as rousing as most of his others. He's guilty. If they want to change or progress or unity, they should make it by sparing Diomedes. But as for Darrow himself, he's not asking for forgiveness. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'ams.
Diomedes' response, however, while shorter, is maybe better in a way. Because he admits, civilization is based on exchange and social contracts. I was taught that the low colors exchanged liberty for security and stability. We have failed to provide security. We have failed to provide stability. We have failed you. The contract is broken. Take your due. Ugh.
Yep.
Yeah. Ugh,
Diomedes.
He's not wrong. Awakening. Yeah, no, he's completely right. We've provided you with terror, torture, and hardship. I don't know that in his position, well, I mean, he is kind of in shock, I guess, still and recovering from the total destruction of his family, but take your due is a big blank check to give to these folks.
Yeah, I mean, I think he kind of just assumes they're all going to die. And he also is in a really bad place right now. Okay. Yeah. He just saw two-thirds of his. So. Yeah, he saw two-thirds of his forces just taken out at Kalike, and then went to his home, and his grandmother, remaining sister, and aunt are missing, and his two younger brothers are dead. He's in a real bad place right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So, which makes it maybe, I don't even know, Cassius read the room, but when they get into the next holding cell and Cassius is in there, he's trying to lighten the mood as they wait to be sentenced. And this is honestly, as much as like I say, read the room, Cassius, this is still also pure Cassius goodness, or maybe pure Cassius hilariousness, to be honest.
Especially when the third cheer from the daughters is the loudest yet, and he grins, claiming, "That must have been for me." At which Darrow rolls his eyes, and Cassius continues, "Come, come, Darrow. Am I not allowed to be the best at anything?" Darrow says, "Fine. You can be the most despised." And Cassius replies, "Thank you. Contrition at last." Because, of course, he does.
Honestly, it's great. That's the best way to lighten the mood here, I guess, is for Cassius to be like, "Let me be the most hated, y'all." Yeah. All right, whatever, dude.
It's in his yearbook.
He won that, what were those things called? That's
his superlative.
Yes, superlative.
Most hated.
I got most changed since ninth grade. You want to know why?
I do. I do now.
Because I got contacts and started wearing makeup and clothes that fit instead of big baggy clothes. Oh, it was literally like a 90s rom-com.
Yeah, 90s high school rom-com. Yeah. You took out your ponytail. Yeah.
Oh.
Oh, boy.
She's All That? Is that what it was called?
Yeah. Yes.
I got most dramatic, which my school interpreted as he does a lot of plays, therefore he's the most dramatic. And I'm like,
that's all right.
That's not what that means.
Well, it's not, but it could be worse. You could have been me getting most changed since ninth grade because you got contacts and,
yes,
I don't know, started like literally started wearing clothes that fit instead of just big baggy clothes. That was the only difference. I grew a couple inches. I went from 5'6 to 5'8. So I guess you could say I slimmed out, but it wasn't like losing weight.
Yeah.
High school. Anyway.
And now Diomedes speaks at last.
It's interesting how he has kind of figured out that It was Atlas all along. Something that Darrow easily believes, especially when he's able to conclude that the goal is Lysander in power. Darrow's like, yes, yes, I believe you, but mostly because I know that it has to be all about Lysander. Like, listen, it is, but also I see Lysander as Regina George. Like, why are you so obsessed with me?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about Lysander now, but Atlas is clearly, he must have set this up well before Lysander came back onto the scene.
Oh, yeah, no, it was originally meant to be Atalantia, but for Darrow's purposes, he needs it to be Lysander. And he's right.
Yeah.
It is, but also Lysander as Regina George.
It just makes me want to, like, cast the other plastics now.
I mean, I buy him as Regina George a lot more easily than I buy him as Paul Atreides, so...
I mean, technically, if you really want it to work, he's more Katie than he is Regina George, though. And using that analogy, Atalantia is Regina George. And I think that actually works pretty well.
Yeah, you might be right. Is Cicero Gretchen or Karen?
Cicero is Karen. Atlas is Gretchen. Because his hair is so big because of the secrets.
Oh my god. I love this conversation. Okay. Maybe it's
get in,
October.
Losers. We're gonna go oppress the low colors.
All right. Well, again, Darrow immediately going to the goal is Lysander's power is not illogical, but it's also kind of hilarious. Maybe, definitely, absolutely, definitely. Diomedes does at least disabuse Darrow of the notion that Lysander was knowingly involved as far as he knew at that point. Because, yes, he recognized something was wrong on the Dustmaker literally at the same time Diomedes did. And hey, Lysander's probably dead anyway. Don't we wish. Don't we wish.
If only.
Yeah. Thankfully. Those cheers they were hearing weren't about killing our boys. Or if they were, Sever reminding them that Fitchner was no angel and that Darrow might have fucked up a lot, but he always tries to change and be better, prevented that from happening.
Darrow watches Sever with pride, thinking that maybe for the first time he has found the same conviction in this part of his life as he does in being a father. It is like both sides of him, Sever Barca and the goblin, have finally melded together. However, Severo might be making one hell of a rousing Severo speech about how they need Ares, they need builders, shields, and the Reaper, but he can't pass up a dig at Cassius, glaring at him as he announces that they also need putrid, spoiled allies late to the fray.
I don't actually remember, even though it was like less than a week ago, but it might have been the late to the fray part that immediately put me into fray.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean,
to be fair, Cassius has the opposite story arc, right?
Right, of course.
From cutting the head off the good guy to being on the side of right rather than.
Yes, yes, for sure. It's not like this is actually a matchup.
Oh, no.
The phrase.
It's not as good as the Mean Girls analogy.
No, not at all. Not at all. I couldn't put that in the summary. That would have been just too much of a story to tell. Well, anyway, since plan A, using Athena's ships, is off the table. It's time for Plan Bashvar. Yeah, I know. Ha ha ha.
Really, though, Darrow makes the whole challenging Faw to a duel of honor thing sound so easy, which Severo hilariously points out is Darrow's marketing mode.
And no, it won't be quite that easy. Certainly not as easy as it was for Ara to convince Diomedes to sign a treatise that makes the Rimgolds not just allies in war, but peers in peace. And for Diomedes himself to be the Rim's Virginia Augustus.
Also, while Aure might really convince Diomedes by insisting that he tell her she is less than him, and he can't, her flicking his nose and causing him to burst out laughing is so adorably awkward. Guess it really is love, isn't it? It is really cute, especially because Diomedes, we've talked about this, I think in our last episode, impassive, has like no words, no expression really. And then all Arai has to do is like, bink, flick his nose. And he's like, ha, 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 ha. I imagine it would be the most ridiculous laugh too. Like from a person who never laughs.
Oh, I hope so.
Just a really weird like cackle or guffaw or something.
Mm-hmm. Like Tom Hanks's laugh in that one scene in the Money Pit, which I've never seen the movie, but I've seen that one scene where the bathroom falls or the bathtub falls through the floor, and he just laughs like,
he's "Oh yeah, lost it."
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Actually, yeah.
Yeah. Just a very awkward laugh. I am a little bit, I will say, taken by this stoic warrior of the rim acting Twitter-pated.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know. Like I said, no.
X-pated.
Yeah.
So then we go back to Lyria for one last chapter. And I get that some random yellows and greens on the rim aren't at all likely to have any clue about Rana's fate. But that said, would they even know who she was? Couldn't Lyria have just tried to pass as a Martian Red working as Sevro's adjunct since she is the former and claims to be the latter anyway?
Seems like.
Listen, I don't know why she invoked Rana's name here, but I feel like I'm going to just go ahead and say that I want that to be a hint that Rana's alive. And sorry, so that is how I will take it.
It's amusing that Sevro spends the entire conversation reminding Darrow and Lyria of all the shitty things that Volga did, particularly the whole "she shot Kavix." I like Kavix bit, but then in the end says she earned her chance to try to turn Volga. Though, to be fair, it's also interesting that Darrow seemed to give that decision over to Sevro in the first place anyway.
But hey, the important thing is an end result that sounds like it means we're gonna get our Lyria Volga reunion. Yay. Maybe, hopefully, I guess we might see in the next episode. I don't know.
Tune in.
Although I do have to agree, when Sevro says she shot Kavix, I like Kavix. It's like, aww, Sevro. Brings me back to that scene in Iron Gold when Kavix is like, go get my cane.
Mm-hmm.
And Sevro, like, he argues with it for a second and then he scampers off to get the cane.
Mm-hmm.
And comes back with it, and Kavix is like, I don't need that anyway. Just wanted to see if you'd go get it for me. And yet here Sevro is like, she shot Kavix. I fucking like Kavix. How
Kavix is the best. Everybody knows it.
I mean, and also, to be fair, Sevro's right. Volga did willingly participate in the kidnapping of the children, unlike Lyria, who didn't know what was going on. But Volga also changed her colors. So with that.
As for In Memoriam, no deaths, other than Darrow's hope that the daughters might have any level of acceptance for him.
Oopsies. I actually went back through these chapters and was like, I'm not missing something. There really were no deaths, right? They're not.
Nope. Unusual, but we've had it happen before.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as we close out the episode, we just want to give a shout out to our Heroes tier patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us. Once again, I'm Tara, along with fellow host Nick and practically permanent guest host Seth. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have. Our next episode, titled Stained, will cover Lyria's POV from chapter 65 through chapter 70 in part 3 of Lightbringer. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.